Welcome to Banyan Books, Branches of Wisdom, celebrating the joy of bright ideas and heartful lifelong learning. Branches of Wisdom is a series of intimate conversations with the world's most influential authors and visionaries. We explore spirituality and the human mind, ecology and culture. Most episodes are recorded with a live audience. You can join our live events and submit questions to your favorite guests. Check out our upcoming schedule at banyan.com. Since 1970, Banyan Books has been a rich oasis at the crossroads of wisdom and philosophy, offering resources for humanity's evolving paths. We're a locally owned, independent bookstore in the heart of Vancouver's Kitsilano neighborhood. Visit us in person or shop online at banyan.com. Please subscribe, follow, like, and leave your reviews for the podcast. And now, enjoy. Hello, everybody. Welcome to Branches of Wisdom, the Banyan Books podcast. I'm your host, Ross McKeachy. I'm very excited today about our special guest, Pico Iyer. First of all, Banyan Books acknowledges that although we have people joining us from all over the world for these live streaming events, the physical location of Banyan Books is on the traditional and unceded territories of the Coast Salish peoples, including the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh Nations. Okay, our wonderful guest today, Pico Iyer, is the acclaimed and best-selling author of 15 books, translated into 23 languages. His four talks for TED have received more than 10 million views so far. Since 1982, he has been a full-time writer on subjects ranging from the Dalai Lama to globalism, from the Cuban Revolution to Islamic mysticism. They include such long-running sellers as Video Night in Kathmandu, The Lady and the Monk, The Global Soul, and The Art of Stillness. He has been writing up to 100 articles a year for Time, The New York Times, The New York Review of Books, The Financial Times, and more than 250 other periodicals worldwide. Iyer has written the liner notes for Leonard Cohen albums, and his in-depth conversations with the Dalai Lama have been published in the book, The Open Road. Today, Pico Iyer is with Banyan Books in conversation about his latest release, The Half-Known Life, In Search of Paradise. Paradise, that elusive place where the anxieties, struggles, and burdens of life fall away. Most of us dream of it, but each of us has very different ideas about where it is to be found. For almost 50 years, Iyer has been roaming the world, mixing a global soul's delight in observing cultures with a pilgrim's readiness to be transformed. In this culminating work, he brings together the outer world and the inner to offer us a surprising, original, often beautiful exploration of how we might come upon paradise in the midst of our very real lives. Elizabeth Gilbert calls this book a masterpiece, nothing less than a guided tour of the human soul. If you'd like to learn more about today's distinguished guest, you can visit him online at picoiyerjourneys.com. Banyan community, please join me in a very warm welcome for Pico Iyer.
Thank you. Thank you so very much, Ross. I really can't tell you how honored I am to be here in this legendary 52-year-old bookshop. Where you're hosting so many of my lifelong friends and heroes. So it's a delight to be here.
Oh, thank you so much for being here, Pico. It's really an honor for us to have you. This book is fantastic. I want everybody to know that. It's beautiful and gripping, and it's one of the most highly recommended books we've had on this show, I would say. So one of the things in the opening of the book, you share a snippet from Ferdowsi, the 11th century Persian poet. And the lines are this: I have made the world through a paradise of words. No one has done that but me. Huge palaces and monuments will fall into disrepair, but I have made a palace out of words that shall never fade. Through this, I have immortalized Iran. These words were spoken or sung by your driver at Ferdowsi's burial site in Iran. And you go on to explain why you had chosen this particular land as the starting point for your inquiry into the search for paradise, following, as you say, an urgent impulse. I'm wondering if you can let our audience know a little bit more about this impulse to look into the human search for paradise and what in your inner life and outer life led to that inquiry.
I think it's a book that very much came out of the pandemic. 20 hours after lockdown was announced in California, my poor mother, who was 88 at the time, was rushed into hospital in an ambulance because she was losing blood very quickly. And I live here in this little two-room apartment in suburban Japan. But as soon as my mother came out, I took these three flights through eerily deserted airports to be with her. And so I was with my mother as she was wavering between life and death for the next 15 months, more or less. And because we were all sitting still during the pandemic, it was the perfect time to reflect on my 48 years of almost constant travel. And I think the question all of us were entertaining at that point was how, in the midst of difficulty, could we find some degree of calm and contentment? And my way of framing it was, how can we find paradise even in the middle of real life and even very close to death, because death was breathing down our shoulders across the planet for the last 2 or 3 years. And as I began thinking about paradise and the various trips that I'd taken, Iran was the natural place to begin, maybe for three reasons. The first is our word paradise actually comes from the old Persian. Second, because it's this fascinating convergence of different visions of paradise, because of course the ruling clerics in Iran have a very precise notion of what paradise is, and it exists in the afterlife, and it belongs to the most fervent of believers of their faith. And there's this huge place in southern Tehran called Zahra's Paradise, which in fact is one of the largest cemeteries on earth, home to 1.5 million bodies. But meanwhile, many of the citizens of Iran, behind closed doors, are creating their own sort of counter-paradises, these very sensual, worldly places, often based on sex and drugs and rock and roll, everything that's forbidden by the ruling clerics. And yet both of them cite great Sufi poets that I think Iranians to this day learn by heart in school, such as Rumi or Hafiz, who know that the only paradise that exists lies within us. And the final little thing I'll say is that even though I'd been studying Iran for a long time, 30 years before I visited, there's nowhere on earth where I have been in such a ravishing vision of earthly paradise as in Iran. I remember I was in the desert city of Yazd, and I went out of my hotel room one evening, the warm, fragrant night. There's the sound of running water. There were colored lights in the trees. I was led to a divan in which I stretched out as a waiter brought me slices of sweet watermelon and strong tea. All around me were these beautiful, dark-eyed young people murmuring sweet nothings. And I thought, my goodness, this is as beautiful as anything I've seen or am likely to see on planet Earth. So as a way of both introducing us to what earthly paradise can be, and asking the question of where paradise may lie, even in a troubled and divided world, I had to begin in Iran.
One of the things that you mention about Iran is that in trying to understand it in all of its complication and contradiction and beauty, it's a difficult thing to do. And I'm going to share a short quote here. You write, "Here in Iran, I was surrounded by some of the most articulate souls I'd ever met. And the more they said, the less I could tell where they stood or where I did. The culture that had officially invented paradise seemed a treasure house of riddles." I'm wondering if, for those of us, Pico, who don't know as much about Iran or haven't been there maybe, can you explain why understanding this land is so beyond anyone's grasp?
I think it's the most layered, the most subtle, and the most veiled place I've ever seen. And as I mentioned before, 30 years ago, I wrote a long article on Iran while in New York City, drawing on the reports of colleagues who had been there. And many years ago, I financed my first book by writing a 20-page article on Iranian history. And then at one point, at the end of the last century, I spent 4 years reading up on and researching everything I could get on Islam and particularly Iran to publish a 350-page novel, partly set in Iran, though I'd never been there. And so I had the notion that, my goodness, I've been studying this place for 30 years. I know something about it. And as soon as I got off the plane, I saw I didn't know a thing. And I was really grateful to be humbled by this. Many in Banyan books probably know how the Zen tradition talks about don't know mind. And the fact of not knowing is a form of intimacy. And what I feel is that our life is determined by everything we don't know. Suddenly we fall in love. Suddenly we meet somebody who pierces us so deeply that we take that person as a teacher. Suddenly a pandemic closes down the world for 2 years. Suddenly one's house burns down and you lose everything you have in the world, which happened to me and happens to so many people, including in British Columbia. And I think of our lives as equivalent to a little tent in the Himalayas late at night. So you may have lanterns in the tent and you probably have a flashlight, but nonetheless, it's this little piece of light surrounded with a vast darkness, the darkness of the night, pockmarked by stars and maybe the silver outline of mountains nearby. But essentially, almost everything that's going on in the world is beyond our reckoning. And I cherish that. That's the nature of faith and our sense that almost everything that's forming our destiny, whether it's a hurricane or whether you think of it as a divinity, it's something we can't begin to explain. And I remember when I was a kid, I was so proud of knowing things. And I think the older I've got, the more I've become grateful for everything I don't know and will never know. So Iran in a very particular place, in a very particular sense, was fascinating because I never began to assume that I could get a grip on it. But in another way, it was a perfect place to start this book because I think life is about rescuing us from the illusion of knowledge. When I'm at home, I'll tell myself, oh, I know everything about Syria or North Korea or Kashmir. And the minute I get off the plane in Damascus or Pyongyang or Srinagar, as with Iran, I see I don't know a thing. And I think the danger of the modern world is in the age of information, we assume we know the world because we get it through our screens. But I think all the images in the world can never add up to real life. And when you see something through a screen, one of the main things you're not getting is the larger picture and a sense of human texture and complexity. So Iran is probably the most complex society I've been in. And it seemed a good way to start this intensive humbling process.
One thing you said early on there was that not knowing is a kind of intimacy. I'm just wondering if you can unpack that statement a little bit more for us.
It's about not being on top of things. It's about not lecturing, but listening. And it's about being in a conversation with another person or with everything that is around us. And I feel that one of the challenges of the modern moment is that so many of us are tempted to say, I know more than you, or I know better than you. And we can all feel how the world is solidifying into tribes and ideologies. And I always feel that reality is what lies on the far side of our assumptions or our theories. And that's where humanity lies too. And that's where our hope lies too. As long as I am entrenched behind a belief and I tell you, Ross, I know this, and this is the right way, there's no way for the two of us to come into contact. And as soon as I say to you, Ross, I don't know what's going on in my life, and you probably don't know either, and however we define ourselves and whatever religious or political groups we belong, we're joined by that not knowing. And I think knowledge separates, and not knowing is something that almost all of us have in common. And when I write a book about paradise, as I just have, I always am reminded that in the Garden of Eden, it was knowledge that was the creation of death. As long as Adam and Eve were not preoccupied with knowledge, they were in this state of blessedness and innocence. And as soon as they started to bite from the apple, they were expelled from Eden. And of course, when they were expelled from Eden, it was to find as an archangel says, a paradise within, happy afar. But nonetheless, I don't find knowledge has ever brought me closer to an understanding of the world. And I do feel that not knowing and openness and humility are where I've had my richest experiences.
One thing that really becomes clear as one reads this book is that many of the great mystics from the variety of the world's lands and traditions, they see no difference in the paradise of the inner world, and that they celebrate the many different ways of approaching the divine or the infinite. I'm wondering if you can comment for us, do you have any insights or points of view on why is it then that religious belief has become such a polarizing force in our world, which is often creating a living hell rather than a paradise? Is it because of that holding on to some knowledge?
Yes, holding on to some certainty and holding on to the assumption that your way is the right way or is the only way. And as you know, at the very heart of this book, I have Jerusalem, which is the perfect model of this, insofar as it's one of the most moving and magnetic cities I've ever been in. And yet it's famously cut up, not just by divisions between the three great monotheisms, but actually within them too, because Sunni Muslim is separate from Shia Muslim and at odds with Shia Muslim. Ultra-Orthodox Jew is angry with his secular cousin. And in really one of the most spiritual places on the planet, the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, six Christian orders sleep under the same roof. And if the Franciscans step one foot over into the Greek Orthodox territory, they start smashing each other with brooms. And yet in the middle of this place of terrible conflict, so the city of faith is a city of conflict, but in the middle of this conflict, even somebody like me, who's not Muslim or Christian or Jewish, gets almost moved to tears by something very real. And almost every day when I'm in Jerusalem, I'll walk along the barely paved alleyways in the pre-dawn dark to a little chapel on the far side of the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. And there's almost nothing there but a rocky ledge and a flickering candle. And who knows why it is? Maybe it's 1700 years of history. Maybe it's all the prayers and devotions that have been brought to that place. But that little empty space really shakes me. But the theories and explanations that I put onto that don't shake me and would divide me. So I think Jerusalem speaks both for a longing for the divine that almost anybody on the planet shares and knows at some point, and the names and categories we impose on the divine, which quickly separate us, because those names and categories are man-made, and yet there's something else there that feels heaven-sent or divine. And as you say, the great mystics in every tradition are really involved in a love affair with the divine. And for example, Rumi, who was the subject of my novel, set partly in Iran, Abandon, you know, threw out all his books and realized that more important to him than the orthodox precepts of Islam was the passion and surrender he felt in his heart towards whatever was deeper and greater than he was. And we might, I know, be speaking about Canada's great mystic Leonard Cohen towards the end of this conversation, but I remember when I was spending time with him when he was a Zen monk, he pointed to his Zen teacher and he said, Sasaki Roshi, he's the same as Rumi. He's the same as Meister Eckhart. He's the same as John of the Cross. The point of mysticism is distinctions and divisions don't apply. Mysticism is a place where all these notions of right and wrong and right and left fall away. And you're in that open meadow where all of us are joined. And so that's why I think many people are drawn to mysticism as liberation from the categories that official religion sometimes insists upon.
I'd like to maybe bring our attention to a possible counterpoint or a point that might seem paradoxical to what we're just talking about. Another theme running through the book, and at the start of chapter two, you talk about this tension between freedom and restraint, or the rule of law and religion, and the unbounded joy of release from constraint. So you're writing about your school days early in chapter two, and you say, we weren't even allowed to walk along one side of the main road that ran through our little town. Why? Because someone in the 530-year history of the school had deemed that freedom is best learned by mastering restraint. And yet, when I left, I had a haunting sense of the gates of Eden swinging shut behind me. Why that haunting sense of the gates swinging shut?
Thank you. Thank you for pinpointing that really important seeming contradiction, Ross. Because I think freedom can only be enjoyed within limits. Freedom doesn't mean you can do anything you want, because that's likely to be a violation of somebody else's freedom. It just means that you have the opportunity to listen to your deepest voice, perhaps. As everybody notices, no game of tennis is fun if there isn't a net. And I remember Hannah Arendt, the great philosopher, was saying recently that freedom means understanding that we are ruled by necessity, because life is going to remind us every day through a hurricane or a virus or a bad diagnosis or a car crash that we are not masters of the universe. We're probably servants of the universe. And I think freedom only has meaning when we accept that servitude, or we accept the fact that we are very small pieces in a much larger story. Here in Japan, where I've been based for 35 years, they sometimes say that life is about joyful participation in a world of sorrows. And that's an old world wisdom that comes from 1400 years of knowing, in their Buddhist context, that nobody lives without suffering. Most of us are subject to sickness. All of us, if we're lucky, go through old age, and every single one of us experiences death. And yet those limits and restrictions and realities don't preclude joy. And that what we have to do is find joy in the midst of difficulty, which I think for me was a particularly salient message in the heart of the pandemic. And as you know, right after the Jerusalem chapter in my book, I have a chapter on His Holiness Dalai Lama, whom I've been lucky enough to be talking and traveling with for 48 years now. And one reason he's there is that I don't think I know anybody who has suffered more than His Holiness. He's been separated from his homeland and his people for 63 years, 64 next week. He's called an evil spirit by the government of the largest nation on earth. He's seen his brother, his mother, his beloved teacher all die. And yet, what is the Dalai Lama famous for but robust confidence, constant smile, and an infectious laughter? And so I think he is the embodiment of leading a life within limits. His hands are tied. He's living in exile. He can't do many of the things he might want to do in an ideal world. And yet he radiates the sense of freedom, which translates to a sense of joy and a sense of compassion. And so I suppose in that early section, I was contrasting California, where there are no fences, with my ancient schooling in England, where there are walls, but actually the walls gave us an occasion to appreciate and enjoy life even more. And that, again, maybe was my feeling during the pandemic. I couldn't go anywhere. I was in a house with a woman who was in her final seasons. Things were difficult. And yet I could find joy there even more sometimes when I'm flying across the world. And I'm guessing most of the listeners to this conversation will know what I'm saying, for all the grief and loss of the pandemic.
You just mentioned the Dalai Lama, and another central figure in the book is Thomas Merton. Mm. And I know that he and the Dalai Lama also had a relationship. About Merton, you say he was someone who saw that paradise cannot be separated from difficulty or squalor. When Buddhists speak of a lotus in the mud, they're reminding us that the most beautiful of flowers has its roots in what we regard as muck and filth. It's only grit that makes the radiance possible. That really reminds me of what you were just saying about the Dalai Lama.
Perfect transition. Exactly. You couldn't have chosen a more appropriate a segue from that. And exactly, it goes back to what we were saying a few minutes ago too, which is the reason I have so much of Thomas Merton in the book is precisely that he was so keen on his final journey after 27 years in his monastery in Kentucky to meet the Dalai Lama. In other words, here is this Catholic monk who is very keen to learn from Buddhism. And here is a Buddhist monk who is really grateful to learn from Christianity. And soon after the three long conversations that Merton enjoyed with the Dalai Lama, out of which he gave us some of the best descriptions we have to this day of the Dalai Lama as he was in 1968, being seen by a discerning monk, Merton went down to Sri Lanka and he traveled out to the Buddhas that are in the countryside there. And looking at a statue of the reclining Buddha and a Buddha's attendant, he had his great moment of realization. After 27 years in a Catholic monastery, Thomas Merton was broken open by looking at two Buddhas. And 4 days later, he died, apparently electrocuted by a fan in Sri Lanka. And so in the context of this book, what is so moving about Merton is even after the 27 years of full-time commitment to his faith, he didn't feel he had the answers. He always felt that the questions were going to be richer and more important than any answers he could give. He actually said, there's more substance in silence than in any answer I could find. And most of all, he was prepared to seek out a Buddhist teacher, and many of them, in fact, in Dharamsala, India, and then to say that he'd found what he'd always been looking for through some Buddhist statues. And I think, again, as the world gets ever more tribalized and divided, I find my hope and my sustenance from those with the wisdom to look beyond their tradition. And in my experience, it's the people who are deepest in their own traditions who are most open to others. It's those of us with a very shallow hold on our tradition who really grip to it to the exclusion of everything else. And again, I think the Dalai Lama is a perfect example, because as the first Dalai Lama in history to be able to spend time outside Asia, he delivers lectures on the Gospels to groups of Christians in England, and tears come to his eyes when he describes the parable of the mustard seed. He's called himself a defender of Islam. He seeks out the wisdom of rabbis about how to sustain a religious tradition outside its traditional homeland. And of course, maybe his greatest passion is science. And the Dalai Lama, probably one of the most cherished religious figures on the planet, published a book a few years ago that was titled Beyond Religion, precisely because he sees, as you said before, Ross, how religion, shallowly held, is making divisions, even though the point of religion is to bring us together. And so he's always pushing us, you know, he stresses secular values, but beyond that, he's pushing us towards those things we have in common rather than those things that separate us. And I think that's why Thomas Merton is so moving to people still, that he was eager to learn from the Sufis, to publish a book on Zen, to assume that as a good Christian, almost his obligation was to learn from every other tradition as well.
I just want to pause a moment to remind our live audience that you can submit your questions for Pico. So go ahead and type them into the chat box on YouTube, and we'll get to as many of those as we can in the last 15 minutes or so. Pico, another interesting phenomenon is one in the human psyche that you contemplate through this book. You say, every place likes to demonize its neighbor. If heaven is here, then hell must be that place across the water. And then again, almost paradoxically, you go on to write, paradise too is the place just across the border. So what is it, do you think, in this inquiry in your book and in your travel and research for the book, what is it, do you think, that determines where and what we see as paradise? Is it just the individual's perception? Is it that simple?
Well, it's never struck me until I just heard the sentences you read out, Ross, but it suddenly made me think the paradise is inside us, but it's not inside our heads. It's probably inside our hearts or our souls, our spirits, however you want to define it. But our heads are the places that make divisions and distinctions. And something else in us is much wiser than that. So just as you said, our head can argue, it's a champion lawyer. It can argue any case and every other case. And an Indian can point to Sri Lanka and say, that's our enemy. That's the country that we're pledged to fight. And an Indian can look across the water at Sri Lanka and say, that's our heaven. That's that's where the grass is greener. That's the place that's not the difficult reality I'm facing here. So I don't trust the mind so much, but I do trust something else inside us. And you know, I'm just completing a sort of companion piece to this book about the 32 years I've spent as in a Benedictine monastery on and off in California, even though I'm not a Christian. And what I find is the beauty of being on retreat and the beauty for me of stepping into silence is instantly I'm out of my head and I'm in something much more spacious. So as I drive up to the monastery every time I've made more than 100 retreats there, I'm arguing with a friend, I'm worrying about a deadline, I'm arguing with myself, I'm fretting over the kind of contradictions that you just described. And I step into this pulsing silence that's not just the absence of noise, but the presence of something very powerful. And quibbling loyally, Pico falls away. I sort of fall in love with the world. And I'm responding to the world in a much deeper and more constructive way than when I'm thinking about it. So your question moves me to suspect that paradise doesn't lie in our thoughts, but it may lie in our intimations or just in our way of seeing. I think paradise is a way of seeing the world and therefore of being in the world. And anybody listening to this conversation has probably experienced what are called peak moments, when you're in love, when you're on top of a mountain, when you're in a place of great sanctity. Suddenly you feel at a level beyond knowledge. This is the way things are. This is the way things are meant to be. And you recollect, as monks say, or recover in yourself something that's much truer and deeper than the you that's chattering in the shopping mall all along the freeway. And so I think all of us at moments touch upon a truth that lies beyond our thoughts. And the challenge is to try and live as much as possible in that space. And I think His Holiness the Dalai Lama and Thomas Merton and other of our great heroes are perfect exemplars of that. The Dalai Lama has a remarkable analytical mind, and he's as precise a scholar and as good at debating as anybody I'm ever going to meet. And yet, the way he makes contact with all of us is really his heart or his presence, you could say, his being.
It reminded me, I didn't have a question about this quote, but I had to write it down when I was reading the book. It's from, you have it in there, and it's from The Cloud of Unknowing, the yeah. Christian mystic text. Yeah. And the quote is, "By our love, the divine may be reached and held. By our thinking, never."
Exactly. And I, as you said before, I think every mystic would sing to that tune. Rumi, whom we've mentioned, certainly most of his poetry was devoted to that. Exactly. And as you were saying earlier, wherever we turn in any tradition and in any work of great truth, I think we're going to find pretty much that same thing. I'm always struck that St. Benedict called his monasteries a school for charity or a school for love. The monk's job there was not to learn theology or just to master all the texts. It was to learn how to love. And I think when I go to my Zen friends, theirs is a school of clarity, and it's a school of seeing the world very precisely and undeludedly. But that is a means to love as well. And I think one reason that in this book I go to very difficult places is I think you can only love the world when you see it in all its complication. It's as with a fellow human being. If you have a sweetheart in your life, if you can see that sweetheart in all her shadows and her imperfections, and if she can see you in all yours, then I think you're on very, very solid ground. If it's just a romance and you assume that she's perfection, disappointment is going to lie along that road. And so I've always felt that as somebody who travels a fair amount, my job is to see the world in all its flaws and contention and yet be able to love it. And I think, of course, that's what somebody like the Dalai Lama does shiningly.
The third chapter of the book, On the Lake, takes place in Kashmir. And you have a special connection with Kashmir through your mother, Nandini, don't you? I'm wondering if you can tell us a little bit about that.
Well, just very briefly, both my parents are from India, though I have never lived there. And as my mother was getting older, I started interviewing her about her life and all her experiences as a girl and before I was born. And she would tell me these ravishing stories about taking long trips with her family to the meadows and the mountains of Kashmir, where they'd stay for 3 weeks, intense camping out, enjoying the beauty of probably one of the most striking physical terrains in all of India. And then when I questioned her further, I realized this was 1941, in the middle of World War II, that she was enjoying that. And it was a reminder of how, in certain contexts, you can find what you need, even in the midst of difficulty, because life is always going to be difficult. And it was also a good instruction when I went to Kashmir a few years ago, because, of course, it's been in the throes of a very difficult and violent 70-year occupation. And yet, when you're on the lake in Srinagar, and you have lotus ponds outside your window and the whir of kingfishers' wings outside your door, and people are rowing up in little boats and selling you fragrant spices and exquisite carved boxes, 10 minutes away from the conflict on shore, it's very tempting to think that you're in a kind of paradise. And so I suppose that's a way of saying two things. One, paradise can be found in the middle of the real world, but that also paradise can't be found by ignoring the real world or pretending that it doesn't exist. And I think as a traveler, that's sometimes the temptation, that we go to Bali or Kashmir or Sri Lanka and say, this is heaven on earth, which it may be as somebody affluent enough to go there for 2 weeks and then to come back to Canada. But it's probably not heaven on earth for the people living there. It's probably real life for them. And they may be dreaming of the heaven known as Vancouver or Santa Monica with good reason. So there are so many ways in which paradise is a projection and it's an illusion. And I think in this book, I was trying to cut through many notions of paradise to find one that I could really trust.
The book starts in Iran and ends in Varanasi. I'm wondering if you can tell us a little bit more about what drew you to Varanasi. Your description of it, you tell us the city it's a city known as a crossing ground, a place for moving from one dimension to another. And your whole description of it is it's gripping and haunting. Another thing you write about Varanasi is that having never lived in India, having never observed the sacred thread rites or Sanskrit incantations of Hinduism, I'd even begun to eat meat as soon as I entered boarding school, I looked on the pinwheeling rites around me as a tourist might, or perhaps worse, I looked on them as I might a coat a grandfather had passed down that didn't seem quite to fit. I didn't in truth come to Varanasi with the open eyes of a typical visitor from afar. As someone born to Hinduism, I assumed that I'd seen through the place already. The one attraction Varanasi held for me was that I was unlikely to mistake it for paradise. So in your time there, did your point of view change, and how so?
Dramatically. And of course, there's a lot I could say to that question, and beginning with the fact that not every reader will notice that the book starts in Iran, as you said, and ends in Varanasi. It also begins in bright summer sunlight in Iran and ends in deep winter fog, which speaks for my experience of life in the sense that you begin with full of certainties and conclusions when you're young. And then you perhaps come to the end of your life in this state of delighted bewilderment and not feeling that you are bigger than life or can explain life away. But one reason to answer your second question, why I came to Varanasi, is it's a very magnetic place. It's a place with charisma, as Jerusalem is. And I think places have charisma as well as people do. And as you said, all my Hindu relatives, because I'm 100% Hindu and it's the great holy city of Hinduism, told me, my parents, both philosophers and professors of religious studies, both Hindu, neither had even dared to go to Varanasi. And my uncles and aunts would say, oh, don't go to Varanasi, it's just a place for tourists. Because I know you spent more time in India than I have, that it's a remarkable place. And the single most striking thing about Varanasi is that it's a city of death, because right at the heart of that holy city are flames burning through the night on to the north and to the south, reducing dead bodies to ash. And all around in the little alleyways, people are carrying stretchers with dead bodies to be committed to the water or to the flames, the holy waters of the Ganges water, the flames. And so the cremation place is right in the heart of the city. and yet the city of death is a city of joy. And the people who are carrying the dead bodies through the streets are offering praise and thanksgiving, and they're a sense of delight. And so death is not the end of everything wonderful. They're so glad that they can commit their loved ones or themselves to the holy place and enjoy moksha, Hindu notion of liberation. And so my notion of Varanasi was completely transformed. And it's not included in the book, but I can tell you that one day I was standing along the ghats, the steps leading down to the holy Ganges, and I was confronting this scene that's as chaotic and shocking and displacing as anything in often chaotic and shocking and displacing India. Dead bodies floating past, the flames on both sides of me speaking of death, people bathing in the holy waters that the WHO has declared to be 3,000 times beyond the maximal level safe for consumption. And as I was standing there, suddenly I heard somebody call my name. And it was two Tibetan monks that I know from New York City, one an elderly Tibetan Rinpoche, and one a younger American monk who is the first Westerner in history to have been appointed abbot of a Tibetan Buddhist monastery in southern India by the Dalai Lama. And when my American monk friend came up to me, he surveyed the scene that to me was really shocking and hard to make sense of. And he said, "Isn't this glorious? This is life and death and everything in between. This is the human reality. This is the great fact of life that we have to love and throw our arms around. Essentially, this is paradise. This is the only paradise we're going to find in the middle of the clamor and the chaos with bodies being burnt on both sides of us. This is where we can find our fulfillment, our sustenance, and our light." And so, as you said, when I arrived in Varanasi, I thought, as somebody born to Hinduism, I'm not going to be taken in by this place. If there's one place that there isn't paradise, it's this, you know, very, very confused, dirty, and disheveled place. And by the end, I saw this place, like any place, is a paradise if only you can see it with the right eyes. And what so moved me about my American friend, who's a Tibetan monk, is that he had the clarity of sight to realize this was not something to be freaked out by or appalled by, but this was something to love and embrace, which I suppose is really the message of the whole book, which is not to think about paradise and that our notions of paradise get in the way of seeing it, and yet there it is, wherever you happen to be. I'm sitting in the ancient Japanese capital of Nara, but down the road in the neighboring town of Kyoto, when you set foot in a temple there, quite often written on the ground at the entrance in Japanese are the words, "Look beneath your feet." In other words, don't look to the future, to some never, never land, to some romantic idea for your paradise. This is it, right now. Make the most of this. And as you know, I make a trip to the holy Buddhist mountain of Koyasan in Japan just before I go to Varanasi in my book. And in that place of impermanence and 200,000 graves, I moved to realize that the reason that the fact that nothing lasts is the reason that everything matters. Precisely the fact of impermanence is what adds the preciousness to life. And I think in the midst of the pandemic, when we were more forcibly reminded than ever of impermanence and uncertainty, probably that was the lesson that I needed to hear. Enjoy this moment. And every day when I woke up in the pandemic, I had reason for gratitude. I was still alive. My wife was still alive. My mother, for most of that time, was still alive. And this pandemic for me was a season for taking nothing for granted. So often in my regular life, I'll really just sleepwalk past and I'll complain about the things that aren't going right and never register the myriad things that are going wonderfully, for which I ought to feel gratitude. And I was glad that the pandemic taught me the paradise is right here, right now. And there are reasons for gratitude probably at almost every moment.
I just want to take a moment to again remind our live audience, we're going to jump into some questions momentarily from you, from the audience. So please go ahead and type those into the chat box on YouTube. Before we do that, a little while ago, Pico, you mentioned Leonard Cohen, and of course, He's a Canadian icon, and many people in the Banyan community are lovers of Leonard Cohen. And you had a long time relationship with him, friendship. I think you met him first in 1995. Is that right?
That's right. I met him first when he was a full-time monk, as he was for 5 years, in the high, cold, dark mountains behind Los Angeles. And I think one of the things that moved me so much, I pulled up into the parking lot, and this stooped character with wire-rimmed glasses and a little red bobble hat was waiting and bowing to me when I got out of my car, and then insisted on carrying my bags to a little cabin, and then started heating up tea and cooking dinner for me. And for the longest time, I didn't realize that the stooped character in the tattered black robes was Leonard Cohen, which is a way of saying that he had gone there to completely dismantle the notion, the name of Leonard Cohen. And what was so remarkable to me then was he was 61. He was putting himself through this very grueling regimen. The time I was visiting was at the end of December, and he was going through Sesshin, which is 7 days and seven nights of almost unbroken meditation. And the rest of the time, he was just scrubbing floors, shoveling snow, and looking after the aged, then 88-year-old Japanese head of the community. And I thought to myself, here is Leonard Cohen. He's already been, as you said, a Canadian icon and really a global icon for 35 years at that point, or 25 years. He could be doing anything in the world, anywhere in the world, with anyone. And he's chosen to give himself to this really rigorous and selfless routine. And again, I remember every time I would visit him in his little, very modest house in a really beat up part of Los Angeles, he would be standing at the door for whomever came to visit, almost like an anonymous grunt waiting to serve. And there were many, many reasons to hold Leonard Cohen in very high regard. And anyone who saw him on his concert tours knows that he exuded modesty, graciousness, and wisdom. But the one thing that I can add is that in private life, he was even more impressive in terms of that kindness, that self-effacement, and of course, his famous droll wit and irony. So I consider myself very lucky to have been able to spend time with somebody I regard as a spiritual teacher, partly, and you know, I was just watching an interview with him, and somebody asked him if he was religious. And he said, I can't claim to be because I violated every one of the Ten Commandments. I believe in sin, and I'm aware that I sin much too often. And I think that degree of self-knowledge and the fact that he knew all the ways in which he wasn't wise are part of the wisdom that he has to share. He always is speaking to us from that broken, fallen position of a flawed human who nonetheless, in Leonard's case, was rising to acts of generosity and of clarity that a saint might envy.
Wow. That's really interesting to hear. Thank you for that. We've got some really nice audience questions coming in here now, Pico. So if it's okay with you, we can jump into those.
Please. Yes. Thank you, Ross.
So there's a couple of questions that touch on this. I'll go to Carlos's question first. Carlos says, do you think of yourself as belonging to a particular spiritual tradition or lineage or following a particular teacher?
I think of myself as a global being, as so many Canadians are, who's been very lucky to have been exposed to many great teachers and many great traditions. And here in Japan, I first came to Japan with the hopes of living in a Zen temple. And although I was too immature to be able to do that, I've been lucky enough to be exposed to many great Zen teachers, as well as Tibetan Buddhist teachers through the Dalai Lama. And I'm very grateful to have spent so much time with my Benedictine friends who really taught me about service and tending to the suffering, not just the suffering in the mind, but the suffering in the world. But I'm also guilty of not being rooted in a single tradition. It's interesting, my official name is Siddharth Pico Raghavan Iyer. So my parents, being philosophers, in their wisdom, when I was born, they gave me for the first name, my first name, the name of the Buddha. For my second name, Pico, after Pico della Mirandola, the Catholic heretic Neoplatonist of the Renaissance. Raghavan was the name of my father, who was a theosophist and therefore was conversant with many religious traditions, and Aya is famously a Hindu priestly name from southern India. So as a little Indian boy born to England and then later growing up in the US and then moving to Japan, my parents probably intuited from the day I was born that it would be hard for me to be heir to a single tradition, but maybe the compensation would be that I could learn from many.
This is an interesting follow-up question to go to from Evan, who says, what role does self-discipline play in your life? Do you have a daily regimen of meditation and writing, et cetera?
Self-discipline, I think, plays too much a part in my life, and I need to be looser and freer than I am. And it's interesting, although I wrote a book on stillness, I've never had a formal meditation practice. But my wife is sitting across the room now, and if you asked her, she would say, all this guy ever does is meditate, because I wake up in the pre-dawn dark, and after breakfast, I go and essentially sit at my desk for 5 hours uninterrupted without a computer or anything there except a pen and paper. And all I'm doing there is sitting still again for hour after hour after hour, trying to hear something deeper than my chatter and trying to see what lies on the far side of my thoughts. And as I mentioned earlier, trying to cut through sort of superficial projections and illusions I have about the world. So it feels to me as if my writing discipline is like every day walking into a cabin in the woods to clear one's head, to try to understand and process everything that's one's feeling and seeing, and then to prepare oneself to go back into the chaos of the world. And so although it's not a formal meditation practice, I think it serves some of the same purpose. And because I've been a full-time writer by myself here in this little apartment for more than 35 years, I have to be very disciplined and probably work much harder than when I used to be in the Time magazine offices in Midtown Manhattan. And of course, Leonard Cohen, I think one of the great things he offered us was an unrelenting sense of discipline. Hard work and discipline was almost his watchword, I would say.
There's a question from Charles here. This is more related to the content of the book. Charles is asking, have you encountered contradictory ideas of paradise from different cultures, or do they all tend to be similar?
I think they all tend to be very, very different, partly because, you know, for example, Islam has a very specific notion of paradise that is limited to those who follow the Prophet and or Allah. And certain forms of Christianity believe that it's only those who follow their form of Christianity who will earn paradise. And so and the Buddhists have a whole different notion of paradise. My neighbors here believe in the Western paradise, which is attainable to Japanese Buddhists. So I think my challenge was to find a paradise that's open to everybody and is democratic and is not making those distinctions. And I think that's the paradise that Thomas Merton and the Dalai Lama and human experience is admitting us to. So I was less concerned with the traditions and their very precise, rooted visions of paradise than a paradise that any of us could access.
A question here from Jane, who says, with growing levels of tribalism in the time of globalization, how can we cultivate collective openness on a wider scale?
I think it's very hard to cultivate collective anything. I only have confidence in being able to cultivate individual openness, and slowly one hopes that if one person is open-minded, as Thomas Merton is, or many people that we know are, slowly that passes on to other people. It's interesting, I was lucky enough to meet the Dalai Lama the day after he was awarded the Nobel Prize in 1989. He was in Southern California enjoying a meeting with scientists at that time, and I barged in on him on this busiest day of his life. And everyone who cared about Tibet was celebrating that day and saying, you know, Tibet's problems are over, it will get freedom from the oppression in Beijing, now everything's going to be fine. And the Dalai Lama, as always, was much, much more realistic. And when I talked to him, he said, you know, I really wonder if I've done enough, but all I can do is work very hard, step by step, day by day, to live as clear a way as possible. And the hope is if I do that, others may join along, and slowly, incrementally, the world will get transformed, but not overnight and maybe not in the next 100 years, but that it would happen on an individual level as each of us arose to the possibilities that we have inside ourselves. So that's how I see the response to tribalism. And in fact, I think we're doing that already, because even as the world is forming into tribes, Canada is a perfect example of this. As we're talking in Vancouver and Montreal and Toronto, somebody of Thai origin is meeting somebody of German origin, and they're falling in love. And the child who arises out of that union is not Eastern or Western or Thai Buddhist or German Lutheran, but a whole new possibility that doesn't belong in the black and white categories. And Canada, more than almost anywhere I can think of, is a place that on an individual level is moving past those divisions for all the imperfections and the animosities that remain. More and more people that I meet, especially in the cities of Canada, belong to several traditions. And so you can't say they belong to this group or that group, because their heritage is all over the place. And I think in that way, the reason nationalism is on the rise is nationalism is on the run, because the nationalists understand that at the individual level, every day we're moving towards a world in which more and more people come from more and more places and can't be pushed into those old boxes.
I think we have time for one more audience question, Pico. This is from, I hope I'm saying your name right, S. Lautensack. And she or he says, travel rather than destination. Thinking of travelers who walked from Germany to Italy, Goth, then immersed themselves in the local culture, what do you think, quote unquote, quick tourism can teach us?
I think quick tourism can teach us how much we don't know, and it can overturn our assumptions. And it does that very, very speedily. And so, of course, it's wonderful really to be immersed in another culture. And of course, walking is a more human and a more humane way of encountering another culture and another person than a 787 Dreamliner. But nonetheless, to take a simple example, when I flew to Iran, I flew from Santa Barbara, California, through Los Angeles and Istanbul, and I arrived in the holy city of Mashhad. And I came out of customs at 3 a.m, and I met my guide, who was dressed exquisitely and who spoke better English than I did, because he had been educated at a boarding school in Britain near London in the 1970s, before the revolution. And we got into the car and we started driving through these unexpectedly crowded streets at 3 a.m. And he started asking me which passerby looked more like Mr. Bean or John Cleese, which is not what I'd expected coming to revolutionary Iran. We got to the luxury hotel left over again from before the revolution, and the Beatles Yesterday was being piped through the lobby. And I saw in one far corner of the lobby a little sign pointing to a small room that was serving as a mosque. But right next to the mosque were two shops offering the latest in cosmetics and fashions from Paris. And I went up to my relatively small and simple room. There was a television, and I turned it on, and there on my Iranian television set was Piers Morgan on CNN talking about gun control. And so this is a very silly example, it's one level. But I'd been in Iran an hour at that point, and already I found I didn't know a thing, even though I'd studied it for 30 years. I never knew that CNN was available in Iran. I never imagined there'd be French boutiques next to the mosque. I didn't realize that in a place in revolutionary Iran, they'd be playing the Beatles in the lobby, and that my guide would be more conversant with the West than I am. And so although those are very simple preconceptions to be dispensed with, they're very useful things to be dispensed. And I know we're coming up to the end of our hour, so I'll just say my first night in Iran, I found a taxi driver to take me to the holiest shrine in the city, which is in fact the largest mosque in the world. It's 7 interlocking marble courtyards. And he took me to the innermost shrine where a saint had been buried for 1,200 years. And as I looked across the room, my taxi driver's hand was on his heart. He was walking backwards, so he would never present his back to the long dead saint. There were tears welling in his eyes. He was just the picture of Islamic piety. But then 5 minutes later, as we were back on the street walking to his car, he told me how his wife was an English woman who was waiting for him in Yorkshire and expecting their first baby. And then he told me how he had paid a human trafficker $2,500 to smuggle him into England in the back of a truck, breathing through the tube so he wouldn't be detected. And then he told me how the British government had given him a lawyer and a translator who had worked for 3 years to win him asylum. So he'd risked his life to flee Iran and to get asylum in England. And now he was risking his life every summer to come back to Iran to see the mother and the mosque and the hometown he missed so much. And so by this time, I had been in Iran for 20 hours. So really very, very quick tourism. And I had learned so much. Because when I was back home, I never read about a really faithful Islamic soul who doesn't want to live in that Islamic republic. And when I'm back home and I'm following the news, I never hear about a dissident stealing back into the country he's fled every single year. And so even if you're somewhere very briefly on quick tourism, I think you have your eyes opened. And if nothing else, you see that you don't have a clue and that everything you thought you know is wrong. So long tourism is the best, but I think quick tourism really serves a useful purpose too.
Thank you so much to our live audience for all of your questions and for always being so wonderful and supporting this Banyan community. We've been speaking with Pico Iyer about his latest book, The Half-Known Life in Search of Paradise. Of course, you can get that at banyan.com. And Pico, it's really just been a treat to speak with you today. I'm very grateful that you took the time to join us.
Ross, thank you for reading my book so carefully, asking the perfect questions, and also for inviting me to be part of really this all-star luminous roster you have at Banyan Books. It's been a great honor to be part of your community. So thank you.
Thanks for joining us for Branches of Wisdom, a podcast of Banyan Books and Sound, Canada's spiritual and healing resource since 1970. Our podcast producer is Jacob Steele. The show is edited by Abdo Habani. And I'm your host, Ross McKeachy. Watch all our conversations on YouTube by searching for Banyan Books or listen on your favorite podcast platform. Please subscribe, follow, like, and leave your reviews and comments. We love to hear from you. For all our live events, books, and more, visit us at banyan.com.